The Tom Woods Show, episode 1228.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, the state sucks the life out of education, and it's long past time to think about alternatives. Check out my free ebook, Education Without the State, over at nostateeducation.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I am sharing with you something really outstanding. The good folks over at the Scottish Liberty podcast, which is hosted by Anthony Samaroff, who has been a guest on this show a number of times, who's a great guy, wonderful libertarian, really well-spoken, very knowledgeable. I mean, this is a guy, remember, I had him on to talk about. We talked about the basic income guarantee, the universal basic income. And he gave a talk on that in front of a left-wing audience. The guy is fearless, and he's got a book coming out on that soon. We'll have him back on to talk about it. So that's Anthony Samaroff. And then Tom Laird, who heads the Scottish Libertarian Party, is the other host. And they decided that for their 100th episode, they would invite me as their special guest. So what you're going to hear is that episode. And what I've done, though, is I did cut out a portion of it. And you can easily find it. Just subscribe to Scottish Liberty Podcast on iTunes, episode 100. It's just about, you know, the whole libertarian drama that's been going on the past couple of weeks. And I feel like my show has gotten so heavy on libertarian drama that I just cannot impose any more of that on you guys. And it's mostly stuff you've heard before, but probably all of it you've already heard. So I just didn't think there was any value in duplicating that. So if you want to hear that stuff, it's at the very, very beginning of the conversation, and you can just subscribe to Scottish Liberty Podcast and start listening. So, but anyway, they're great guys, and congratulations to them on 100 episodes. Now, the drawback here is that the way the hookup worked, if we talked over each other, it silenced the other person's microphone, and that's always tricky. So sometimes a word of mine will just drop out. Like, for example, at one point I say, I don't talk that way. That's government speak. But you don't hear the word speak because they started talking and it knocked that out. So unfortunately that happens, but it doesn't mean you can't understand what we're about to say. You'll have no problem at all. And I think it's a fun conversation with a couple of really terrific guys, and I wish them all the best over in Scotland. All right. So having said that, here we go.
You know, in the U.S., of course, we have media that have certain sympathies. So MSNBC is known as the more left-leaning network, and Fox News is the more neoconservative network. And, you know, I've had choice words for the neocons over the years, and to the point where I had people on my own side saying, look, Woods, enough's enough already. I mean, you got to focus on the left. Now I focus on the left, and they say, Woods, come on now, enough's enough with the left. What about the right? But anyway, I just want to first point out that I have had choice words for the neoconservatives and written a lot against them and stood against them. But the fact is that even though you could say that there are some parts of libertarianism that ought to appeal to the left, you know, the anti-war, the civil liberties, free thought and all that.
Yeah, liberalization of drug laws.
I beg your pardon?
The liberalization of drug laws.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Liberalization of drug laws, right. But the fact is MSNBC generally does not go out of its way to, you know, to roll out the red carpet for us the way Fox News does. Now, that's true. You know, we're not exactly their number one guest, but I have a million times better chance getting on there than I do. Although I have been on MSNBC, but the bottom line is it hasn't worked. The overtures to the left that they've made simply have not worked. They have generated nothing. Because why does the left need them? The left does not need them in any way. What do we need you for? You're unreliable on some of our most important stuff. Why would we need you? And your pathetic attempt to suck up to us only makes you more contemptible.
Yeah,
absolutely. They'll just keep on pushing the line a little bit further and pushing the line a little bit further. Now, under Bush, I could see why at that stage you might think that the libertarian movement had more sympathies with the left than right. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, since then, the worm has definitely turned. And we do tend to talk more about the left than the right. I mean, we've got shows on the alt-right, we've called them out on all sorts of business, but I feel like I hate to use this term because it sounds like such an alt-right term, but in the culture war, it's like the left is the force to be reckoned with.
Certainly in academia.
Yeah, in academia. and the media and in politics and, you know, and in entertainment, it's just a monolith. It really is a monolith, such that if there is an oddball who has a free thought or a dissident thought, that person makes the news because of what an oddity it is. So, yeah, and also I think we can get a glimpse at what rule by the hard left might look like in the way they run universities and they run other institutions, where one side is clearly privileged. And, you know, the hilarious thing is their use of the word privilege. They privilege their own point of view to the exclusion and complete demonization of others. So that's why I think it is worth focusing on that, because it, as I say, it gives us a glimpse into what life could be like under a, you know, a President Elizabeth Warren or something.
It adds the threat because, I mean, there's always something to bribe people to vote for you for with when you're on the left. Like, there's lots of government, whereas the right are losing because partly because they can't offer that many bribes. I mean, yeah, the military industrial complex and their corporate companies are a force to reckon with, but it's nothing compared to being able to bribe every man, woman, and child with free healthcare, welfare, this, education. There's so many goodies to hand out, you know, and the right just cannot reckon with that, bribing people for free stuff.
Do you think this is maybe behind some people in the libertarian movement, especially in the US, California, I think in particular, there's a lot of libertarians there who are all for the...
basic income?
Yeah, the basic income thing. Zoltan Isbahn, he's banged on about it. He says he's got some new way of paying for it by selling off federal-owned land, which is probably stolen in the first place. But he reckons he can pay for it some other way. Why do they fail to see the trap of the universal basic income?
Well, I don't know what their... Well, I can tell them what the trap is. I don't know what the mental block, other than I think for some people, and the thing is, you know, people attribute motives to me that I don't have. And so I hesitate to attribute motives as to why they're doing it, because in some cases it could just be outright cowardice, and that I'm sick and tired of being so out of the mainstream and being viewed as such an oddball. Maybe if I came up with this public policy proposal, I might get on the table. You know, I think there's a little bit of that, but also it could generally be, they say, this would be an improvement over the current system, but whether it is or it isn't, and that's debatable. The point is, you're not going to replace the current system. That's not how it's ever worked. It never works that way. Mm-hmm. You just add another layer on
the current system.
Yeah.
I believe that someone's just about to release a book on the universal basic income from a libertarian perspective.
That would be handy.
I remember that something about that's coming out in September. I think September the 2nd.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's by, if I'm remembering this correctly, it's by a guy who had the guts to get up in front of a left-wing audience and make a presentation about it. They say, if only the left libertarians who bother me could spend their time doing that, have the guts to do that, as the same way I've had the guts to stand up to the right wing, then we'd be getting...
Yeah. Very noble. And I love when you tell that story. In fact, you can tell the story about how you were about to give a speech and you weren't sure if you should do it or not. It's a great story. Tell it.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, this was in Los Angeles, and we had a really mixed group there because it was a Nullify Now event. So we had 10th Amendment people, libertarians, constitutional conservatives, but we also had just some regular old mainstream Republican types. We had plenty of veterans in the audience. We had people wearing Operation Desert Storm veteran hats. That was the Iraq War in 1991. And I was going to give a talk hitting all the major issues, domestic and foreign. And then I get up there and I thought, well, you know, for this audience, maybe I should just focus on the domestic issues because there'll be too much disagreement on the foreign stuff. But really what I was trying to do was rationalize cowardice. I was hoping to just get up there, give a crowd pleasing speech, get my standing ovation, and then go out to Denny's, and that would be the end of it. Mm-hmm. And instead, I honest to goodness thought to myself, could you imagine Murray Rothbard saying, I better not deliver this hard message to this crowd? Impossible to imagine. So I got up there and I gave that. I spent most of the time. By the way, I think it's an object lesson in how to do this, to be honest with you, because I look back on it. I'm actually kind of happy with how I wound up in my panic how I wound up handling it, because I spent the first major chunk of it building up some capital with those folks, making quite clear where my allegiances were. And so I brought them along with me. They were eating out of the palm of my hand. And then I said, but the same way I don't believe them on domestic policy, I don't believe their foreign policy either. I don't believe what they say. And then I not only did I say, I think this is wrong, or maybe American interests would be better served if we did X or Y. I don't use language like that. I don't talk about American interests. That's government.
Yeah.
I don't talk that way. So instead I said, now look, here's what's going on over there in the Middle East. And here's what people like the folks in this audience have been, have consented to and even encouraged. And so I talked about, the humanitarian disaster. And that if this were an earthquake somewhere on Earth and people were dying and malnourished, well, everybody would be all tears and pity and we'd be having a benefit concert for them. But because it's victims of a war where we've demonized those people, they're not even on our radar. And I pointed at them and I said, you are better than this. You people who lecture us about moral relativism all day, this is the worst moral relativism. Well, if the U.S. government says these aren't people, then I don't even need to think about their humanitarian catastrophe. You're better than this. Knock it off.
Hmm.
And I got a standing ovation from them anyway. You know what? It goes to show you say it and they realize that this guy's real. And they also realize he could easily have gotten up here and just given us that crowd-pleasing speech.
They respected your integrity and that you told them what you really thought instead of hiding.
And you know what? Can I say one other thing about this, Anthony? You know, especially people who have followed me a long time. I mean, I have over 1,200 podcast episodes, okay? That's a whole lot. But not just podcast episodes. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I've got out there online if you look around. And for people who have listened to any fraction of those, they know that what I most want to do on my program is build up my guest and tell people all about the wonderful work this guest is doing.
Yeah, and you did it very wonderfully.
And I appreciate that. And a lot of the people I have on, my folks have never heard of before. And I say, you know, I've got this platform and I want to use it to take people who are unjustly in obscurity and bring them out to the light and to the general public and say, here's another person, just to show how deep the libertarian, to use an American expression, how deep our bench is, to show that it's not just five celebrities. We actually have some great people, and then those people know great people, and it goes really deep. So I am not the sort to spend the time of the guest talking about my accomplishments. I want to talk about them, and I want to highlight them. But lately, I have had to go into, look, you snots. Crying out loud, you're forcing me to be in this mode. But look, I've done some stuff that that demands respect. And if you don't want to respect it, then go take a hike, because you haven't done it. And I'm not saying you haven't written best-selling books, because that's hard to do. I get that. That's hard. There's a little luck involved. You know, it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. But you haven't even tried. I mean, where are on that side, the carping critics? Where's their Dave Smith? Even
right,
you know? Well, where's their Michael Malice? Where, like, people who are up and comers, who are smart, who are doing things, who are accomplishing things? Where are their scholars? Where are they? What are they doing? Who are their people who could, if they gave a speech, you know, fill a hall with hundreds of people? I mean, where are these people? So I have to go up to them and say, I'm doing the stuff you should be doing. You're saying I should criticize the right more. I'm the only one doing it. Like,
you're right.
Things about the right wing from your stupid computer keyboard, but I'm the one who's actually out there doing it, and you're going to criticize me because I'm unfashionable. It's just, anyway. So I have been doing that lately, and then for a few days from now, I'll stop that and I'll get back to being the mild mannered Tom Woods.
Cool,
excellent.
Well, I like it. Yeah, what you said reminds me, like, Tom says sometimes he's sick of libertarians being patronized by conservatives, like where they're.
Yeah, like we're like the kid brother, you know, like the idiot. You know, you're a libertarian. Oh, that's so cute. That's nice. You know, once you grow up, though, you know, realize, you know that's the kind of attitude. You know, there's a little libertarian streak in us all, and you go, well, you couldn't make it a little bit wider, could you? You know, so it's a little bit more obvious, because I'm sure it's the same in the States, but here in Scotland, definitely, and in the UK, the conservatives are a shambles. Really, you know, the only reason they're there and in power is because the left have nothing to offer that's remotely competent at the moment. Right. You know, so but the, in terms of anything remotely resembling a conservative value or principle, they're bereft.
Yeah, and what I add to that is the same. They don't turn up to the fight to defend capitalism.
No, they never make a moral argument for capitalism,
or even a utilitarian argument for capitalism, any argument. They apologize for, oh yes, we fundamentally, the free market's good, but like, you know, we need good regulation and blah, 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 all that. So it's like, I think long-term libertarian, if we were to have any chance of retaining a market economy, libertarianism has to replace conservatism. Dinosaurs will die, you know, as the primary force in politics. I mean, I don't, and when I say conservatism, you know, I mean big C conservatism. I don't mean conservative values or things like that, but as a political doctrine. And I think Rand was great saying that the conservative arguments for capitalism are like, oh, men aren't good enough for socialism, and oh, capitalism's good because tradition because we've had it for a long time, or the religious argument for it. And she went, guys, this is when you say that your philosophy is not based on reason and evidence, you're basically saying that reason and evidence belongs to the left, and that's why she hated conservatism. Please come back.
Well, that is, in fact, I like Michael Malice's point that conservatism is progressivism going the speed limit.
I like it.
I don't know if you guys have speed limits in Scotland, but we sure have them here.
We have anarchy here, so there's no speed limits. We don't even have roads.
So. We have 20 miles. We have 20 miles per hour speed limits in Edinburgh, which is ludicrous because at most times you'd be lucky to approach something like 20 miles per hour, you know, because you'd be in such heavy traffic.
Okay, I've never been over there. I'd like to get over there someday.
Oh,
well, yeah, you should do it. You should get yourself a show at the Edinburgh Fringe. It's just about to finish at the moment, the big festival, you know, biggest arts festival in the world. It's just about finishing here. But it's crowded with left-wing shows. There's always something like, what, ridiculous, like 200 feminist-themed shows or something like that?
Maybe 100, yeah. But like too many.
Too many. too many. One too many.
Having come from it myself, I know what a mess it is. But the thing is, what I also know, having come from it, is that there are a lot of people who are stuck in it just by default.
Yeah.
They don't really know. Now, in the age of the internet, it's a
cultural attachment more than anything else.
Yeah. Now, in the age of the internet, it's a little trickier to claim ignorance of libertarianism.
Sure.
Which I genuinely could in the early 1990s. I knew there was a Libertarian Party, but that was all I knew. So I just thought, well, I'm not on the left, so I guess this is where I am. And that turned out not to be quite right. So I can reach a lot of those people because I know the frustrations that they feel. They say, well, I believe in this, and yet the people who speak for me are pretty terrible at speaking for me. And then also I can show them there are some inconsistencies in the way they think. Why are they so skeptical of the claims of the state in some areas, but in the most crucial areas, the lifeblood of the state itself, whether it's the Fed that they don't really know anything about, it's not that they cheerlead for it, they don't know anything about it, or the military or law and order and stuff like that.
Yeah.
On this, it's just cheerlead, we love these government employees. Well, hold on, come on. So I can reach them in a way that a hectoring leftist couldn't reach them. Now, at the same time, I can't reach the left as effectively because I can't, in the same way the left bring themselves, you know, talking to the right. But the funny thing is, without trying, I have brought people over from the left, and I don't get those people. Those, I have to say, must be the most open-minded people on this earth, that they were willing to sit through Tom Woods and actually learn and change their minds. I had someone just the other day on Twitter saying, I'm not kidding you, I was a hardcore social justice warrior before. And she said, now I'm totally for Tom Woods. And all I can say is you're a wonderful person, because I don't know how you did that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's so great.
Was there anything remotely, you know, resembling a Damascene moment for you? Or was it something gradual? When was the point you can look back and say that's when the penny dropped, so to speak? in terms of libertarianism?
Well, you know, it took me a lot longer than it takes people today, and not just because they have the internet and I don't, but rather because I had at once a very thick head and a very open mind. So I would, I would, in a flighty way, flip from one thing to another. Like I've told the story before of how because of my, in the four, the personalities thing, I'm a sanguine sort of, and I would jump onto something, really get enthusiastic about it. Like I'd go to the bookstore and I would find this book on how I could teach myself Italian, and I'd be so excited. And then after chapter one, I would move on to something else. Oh my gosh. You mean I could learn such and such by reading this book? And it would just be da 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 da. Well, in the 1990s, I was that way ideologically. It was, oh, this one's interesting. So that, whatever. So I started off as a middle-of-the-road member of the Republican Party in the U.S. So middle-of-the-road moderate meant I was bad on all issues. I was bad on foreign policy. It really is true. I favored intervention domestically and foreign, and that made me a moderate. So that was bad. Then I went to college and I became much more clearly defined as an ideological neoconservative. No question about it. I was all for the U.S. empire. Then I discovered libertarianism, and that pulled me in. Like, I met Murray Rothbard. I read a lot of his stuff. I was very impressed. I could not follow them the whole way, but I was intrigued.
Right.
But then I fell in with the so-called paleo conservatives, who were the anti-war, they want
Cannon types. Yeah,
exactly. They wanted to bring the troops home, but they were for protectionism and they had some other deviation, let's say. But I kind of bought into that for a while. And in fact, I even have a little something I wrote that clearly implies that free trade's a bad idea. So I went through that phase for a number of years. And that's when all my enemies today, they like to point to those years and say, look what a terrible libertarian Woods is. Yeah, I know. When I wasn't a libertarian, I was an awful libertarian. So that finally, the thing that convinced me, actually, although this isn't exactly going to appease those people, was I was talking back in around the year 2000. I was talking to Hans Hoppe, and I was just laying out for him, these are my problems with libertarianism. This is why I can't be one. So again, going to show, I really didn't think of myself as one. And you can't, in the 1990s, you can't find a single thing I wrote where I identify myself as a libertarian. Not one. So, but yet again, they're all obsessed with those years. Okay, I get. Look, I've already told you. But I told him, and he said, "Wait till my new book comes out. I think it addresses a lot of your concerns." Okay, I did. Well, his new book was Democracy: The God That Failed, and I read that, and I thought, I think I can be an intellectually fulfilled libertarian at this point. So that if there had to be a moment, it was, I had read a lot of the literature, but the cumulative force of that combined with the addition of that one book, and I said, okay. And plus, I felt like conservatism and the paleo, I felt like it just wasn't going anywhere. Right. And there was a lot of energy with the libertarians. And so all that combined to kind of bring me on board.
Okay. And did you go straight from that? Did you go from the deep end? Did you go straight from that to ANCAP?
Yeah, I did. At no time, even those couple of years where I was reading Rothbard, I had never been an ANCAP at that point. In my mind, I just couldn't imagine how it would work well enough. But what's interesting is that especially since the internet, there have been so many more people who have filled in blanks, who have helped to explain a lot. I mean, I think Bob Murphy has made some important theoretical contributions, but there's a bunch. There's a bunch of great people. Michael Humer has done some good stuff. Gary Chartier. There are a lot of people who have kind of moved it a little bit farther along so that it's easier for my mind's eye to conceive of what it would all look like. And so it's easier to be an ANCAP today, I think, than ever.
For sure. I think back in the day when he was talked a lot about libertarianism, Stefan Molyneux even had some good ideas on how certain things would be handled at a state. At least he influenced me. And what I actually want to ask you about is, how would you judge the ratio within the libertarian movement of ANCAPs to minarchists? Because online it seems to me that more people are ANCAPs than minarchists, but I don't know if that's what it's like when you get to the ground, the grassroots in the US?
That's a good question. Honestly, within the overall movement, the problem is, I hang around with ANCAPs all the time. So I am, you know, skew in that direction. But then also, when you go online, you go on social media, as you say, you do see an awful lot of those people. But then if you were to go to, let's say, the Libertarian Party convention, then I think you would run into a lot of minarchists, certainly. But you would run into more ANCAPs than you would think in a political party.
Yeah.
In fact, I had the head of the Libertarian Party of Canada on my show, Tim Moen, and he's an ANCAP. And I said, how on earth? And I'm not saying that it's incompatible, because I could imagine ANCAP strategically saying, I'm going to use the political system. It's not that. It's how do you campaign? Or how do you debate? You get on that stage and they say, okay, you want to privatize the military. You have 60 seconds to explain yourself. I don't see how somebody does something like that. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it's hard. So I don't know. I mean, I certainly think the ratio is getting more and more top heavy with ANCAPs. But honestly, it would just be a gut instinct. I mean, my gut instinct would be 25% ANCAP. That's my gut instinct. I mean, a social media is 75%. But I think the average person who says, you know, I'm going to vote for Gary Johnson has probably never even heard that there is an ANCAP option.
Yeah. I mean, I would describe myself as a theoretical ANCAP and a practical minarchist in terms of I have no problem with anarcho-capitalism in theory. I think it's a great, I think that's, it makes perfect sense to me. But getting there, how we get to that from the current situation is maybe, and being leader, obviously, of a political party that takes takes part in the political system, not because I have any great belief in the political system itself. It's just something, it's just a platform. It's just another platform to use. And you've got to be very careful how much you compromise with it, because it just destroys you. But there would be no point of having a party if we'd say, okay, we're an ANCAP party. Okay, well, what's the point of you then? You know? So I think that the party itself retains a minarchist position. So I call myself a practical minarchist, but theoretically, I'm in the ANCAP camp. If that makes any kind of sense.
Yeah, and with me, this has never been an issue that I have felt compelled to debate endlessly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun to talk about over drinks, but I mean, there are ANCAPs who just cannot imagine having productive relationships with minarchists, and I just think that this is just not a useful way to think, people. You know, or so I don't think that way. I have plenty of friends who are minarchists, and No, I'm not going to break with them.
People's front of Judea, you know, is playing off. But yeah, I guess that pragmatically I'm a gradual reductionist, but philosophically I'm an ANCAP. Should we debunk some historical myths? This has been great. Like, I don't mind us freestyling. It's been really fun.
Yeah, go for some historical myths.
Yeah, maybe we could do it depending on how many you have, we could do it in a lightning style. So I don't use all the time on the first one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So what's wrong with, you probably heard this a million times, but you know, we're supposition, I can't get my head around this. What's wrong with saying that the Civil War was American Civil War, I should add?
Yeah,
so
not the English Civil War.
The issues. Well, let's
not even go into the problems with even calling it the Civil War.
Right. That opens up a lot of other issues. All right. Well,
why wasn't it about slavery? Wasn't it about slavery?
Let's call it the War of Northern Aggression.
Just for fun.
That'll get all those big fans of mine out there real happy. You got to take this on. You know, this is in a way the founding myth of the U.S. Empire.
Okay.
Is the Lincoln myth. And if you're not going to take this on, then that's okay. There's a division of labor here. But don't go hectoring those of us who want to, because it is the founding myth of the U.S. empire. Because in fact, I should probably write an essay with that title, as fleshing that out.
But to
keep us focused here, I think that it's fair to say that the Southern secession had plenty to do with slavery, given that they said so in a number of the documents in which they seceded. For example, South Carolina, December 1860, made quite clear that was central to its decision. But this is a conflation of two different things. The question is, was the war about slavery, not was the breaking away?
Right.
And war certainly was not about slavery, at least at the beginning, given that Lincoln was quite prepared to come to some kind of an arrangement and was, in fact, was willing to I'm not even sure that this could be done, but was willing to amend the Constitution to forever protect slavery where it existed. So there could be no abolition. He would have done that if he could keep the states together. And he was not in favor of, we'll just put it this way. The first at least 18 months, there was no attempt to end. There was slavery was still going on in some states that had not seceded. And there was
Northern states were still returning runaway slaves.
And that is true. Now, in fact, Judge Andrew Napolitano, who's a big television personality in the U.S. and who's a hardcore libertarian, got in trouble on John, what used to be John Stewart's program, the Daily Show, because he pointed out that the Fugitive Slave Act was actually still being enforced during the war. And he was lambasted for this. Oh, that's not true. So I made a video for him on YouTube where I just pulled out the documents and I showed it was not a whole lot, but the question wasn't a whole lot or a little. The question was yes or no. And the answer is yes. So the judge was right. And this gaggle of historians or herd of historians, as Ralph Rako called them, they were wrong. So, and moreover, Lincoln was very much, he said in his first inaugural, he had nothing, no problem with the Fugitive Slave Act. No problem with any of this. But moreover, if all you talk about is slavery, then you miss also, it's not to say slavery is a trivial thing. Obviously, if you abolish slavery, this is a great step forward for mankind, as it was throughout the Western Hemisphere, where it almost never involved a war. It never involved a war. It involved some violence in Haiti, I suppose. But to me, the big thing is it solidifies in people's mind the idea that the central government can be an engine of progress if only it's unleashed to carry out violence. Because you say, look, after all, they abolished slavery. That's true, that is true, and that's not a small thing. But those same regimes, highly centralized regimes, also brought about World War I. A civilizational catastrophe that would have been unimaginable on a scale like that for the frugal monarchs of Europe, that they could have had endless troops, endless money, inflation all they need, income taxation, institutions that were basically unknown up to that point. So you had more casualties in that war than you had slaves in the South. So that engine of liberation can be an engine of mass destruction of civilization. But for my left libertarian friends, there's this naivete about this. And I don't think we should have that. This was the American unification process. This was the process whereby this loose confederation of states became a centralized regime. And this was the age when Germany became centralized. Italy became centralized. Japan is moving towards centralization. And that becomes the model for the whole world. And in fact, I would say the political libertarians in America have that as their model. We're going to have a one unified regime where individual rights will be protected by a central government. That's not, this is my daughter, little Sarah. But that's not really how it works. What you need are, you need to break power up into little bits, and then maybe you'll have some chance. But the idea that you're going to have one indivisible central government that can't be challenged by any of its constituent parts, and it will enforce individual rights, is not, I think, a sustainable position.
Right. Did the North at any time, did they make any serious attempt to buy the slaves? Did they make any serious attempt to compensate slave owners?
No, there wasn't. There's a part of us that thinks, well, why should they? Because, why would you wouldn't compensate a thief if you take away his stolen property, So likewise,
maybe cheaper than a war.
Exactly. A libertarian recoils at this because of what it involves. But with me, I would say on something like that, do I want purity or do I want to avoid what now historians say the old figure is wrong, 800,000 deaths. We used to say 620, but they're now saying it's more than that. If I could avoid 800,000 deaths with some payoffs, I would. I'll just say that. And it doesn't mean that I would do it only in this case. If I could have avoided World War I with some payoffs, maybe I would have.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's quite a lot of food for thought, even broader than I realized. You wrote a book called How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization. Now, the widely heard prevailing view, I would suggest, is that after the Roman Empire collapsed, the church was force, the predominant force, the prevailing force in Europe. And it held science and civilization back by doing things like saying you couldn't say that the earth went round the sun and things like that. What is wrong with the view of history that says that the Catholic Church basically retarded civilization?
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, that is why I wrote the whole book. So,
give us the elevator pitch.
We'll pick one area. Let's say that I think science is the area that most people don't say they held back agriculture. You know, they say that they held back science. And in fact, the monks were actually real pioneers in agriculture. But when it came to science, the standard view was that, you know, that the church was just an obstacle because the church believes in religion and science believes in evidence. I mean, like, it's about that level. But what the mainstream, and you don't have to trust me, you can just go look it up. What the mainstream now teaches about this is that there are reasons to disbelieve this. Some theoretical and some based on the historical record. The theoretical would be that the church and its theology taught the idea that the universe is a place of order and mathematical regularities and relationships and patterns.
Yeah.
And that really is what science is trying to do, is it's trying to reduce the phenomena of our experience down to formulas, basically, down to a series of mathematical relationships. So you expect to find that in an orderly universe. And when you're raised in that kind of a milieu, you're more likely to go out and expect that the scientific method will work, because in an orderly universe, you can repeat an experiment under the same conditions and expect the same results. So the consensus overwhelmingly was that although God has the raw power to perform, although God has the raw power to perform any miracle he wants, this is not how he normally behaves. He's built this orderly universe, and so on and so forth. So, but what's particularly striking is that we have so many people within the clergy who are actually pretty interesting scientists. So the first person to measure the rate of acceleration of a freely falling body was Father Giambattista Riccioli, or the founder of Egyptology. Oh, look, I know all these people. Father Athanasius Kircher, the father of Egyptology. It was a Father Roger Boscovich was the father of atomic theory, and it goes on and on and on. When you study the history of mathematics, you find that the Jesuits really dominate there, because 5% of the greatest mathematicians were Jesuits, and they were only around for a tiny sliver of the history of math up to the point of that pole. So, and then the study of earthquakes, dominated by the Jesuits. So they even called earthquake seismology is called the Jesuit science, because they dominated that. They wrote the major textbook on it. So the point is that if you're going to try to claim this, you have a huge, huge pile of countervailing evidence against you. So, you know, at least for our purposes for this short thing, because I'm not doing this in a lightning round at all. I'm terrible. I'm taking way too much time with these answers.
No, it's always to have satisfying answers.
Isn't it true as well that who was the guy who discovered, who postulated that the planets went round the sun and not the other way around?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the Catholic Church persecuted, I think...
Galileo.
That was, anybody who's looked at that, even, you know, based, you know, a summary fashion, finds out, well, it was actually the academics who went to the church, because they were angry. It was actually the secular academic guys who believed the Ptolemaic cosmology. They went to the Catholic Church and as a last resort, and says, okay, this guy, Galileo Galilei, is teaching stuff that is contrary to Scripture, which, of course, it isn't contrary to Scripture, but that's the way they looked at it at the time. So he was really persecuted at the behest of secular science, because they couldn't do anything about him, and they couldn't shut him up in the secular world, So they had to get the Catholic Church to do it for him. That was my reading of that episode.
Yeah. I mean, look, it has to be admitted that this is not exactly a shining moment. And it has, bitten them in the rear over and over and over ever since. But it's just that when you look at the actual personalities involved and what really happened and the historical story, I mean, remember, this is happening in the 16th, well, at least, I mean, obviously Copernicus wrote right around the time that Luther died, the 1540s. And then this is persisting into the next half century and into the 17th century. So this is the age of the Reformation and the aftermath of the Reformation. So there is that pressure, this idea that that you can have this individual interpretation of scripture that some Protestants believed in. And it kind of sounded like that's what Galileo was doing. He's saying, well, look, don't worry, I'll reinterpret those scripture verses for you. I got this all in hand. Well, hold on a minute. Will you? You some scientist can do that for us? But also, he had this way of not ingratiating himself into the favor of people he should have. So, for example, he was welcomed and feted by cardinals all over the place. And Copernicus had dedicated his book to Pope Paul III, and it had been made clear that there was no problem with teaching the Copernican theory. Until there's evidence, like, they still couldn't answer the argument from Aristotle, which involved stellar parallax. So it was a long story. I've explained this on YouTube if anybody wants to. But the point is, they couldn't answer some of the scientific arguments. So the posture was, until we get a really good answer to the scientific objections, well, we have to take this as tentative because we do have some scripture verses that seem to go in the other direction. But we could, just say we had misunderstood those if we have overwhelming evidence. So Galileo gets to a point where he starts portraying the Pope. He writes out this dialogue. He portrays the Pope as the dunce in the dialogue. So you have that. You have the pressure of the referee. So I think the way they responded was obviously not to be celebrated, but you can see it as being a drama that was peculiar to that particular moment in time. And then moreover, after that, there appeared to develop a consensus that everybody kind of knows that the criticism of Galileo was more or less directed at Galileo, and scientists could just more or less go on as they had been before. Because the Jesuit universities were all teaching Copernican cosmology.
Interesting. So do you want to ask Tom one more, and then we could probably let him go?
I'd like to ask maybe two more.
Push it, why don't you?
Yeah. Okay. One of the things you say to promote your free history course, which I think above the URL for is freehistorycourse.com. Got that right?
Yep.
Okay. There you go. You even got a free plug.
That's right.
One of the first things that you learn when you become a libertarian is that most of the presidents that people think are good were actually terrible. So could you give us a quick rundown of some of the five overrated presidents and one or two things each of them should make not just libertarians, but most people think that they're terrible?
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, I guess we should do, we'll do the 20th century, but I'm going to pick them at random, not in chronological order. All right. So quickly, Franklin Roosevelt, everybody loves him because he saved the country from the Great Depression. Then the honest historians say, well, he didn't really, but he gave us hope, and I, one of my friends says, well, if you fall down into a well and somebody shouts, okay, there's a ladder coming. All right, the guy with the ladder is almost here. Okay, we're just about to get the ladder, but there is no ladder. Yeah, they're giving you hope, but what good did that really do? Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So even if he did give them hope, but if you look at every single one of his economic policies, basically was designed to retard economic recovery. Every single one. Crazy agriculture policy, crazy policy trying to restrict industrial output, and then raise wages during a depressed economy. Everything was just nuts. So that'd be the first one. Okay. Woodrow Wilson would be another one. And that could be partly because the Federal Reserve was created under him. And you could come up with some other domestic regulatory stuff. But the main thing would be the elephant in the room with him is intervention in World War I, which was based on preposterous grounds, double standards, and that led to all kinds of bad consequences for the U.S. and Europe. Teddy Roosevelt would be another one. Everybody loves him. But he, his view was that I, as as president, I ought to be able to do whatever I am not prohibited from doing. And so there was an example of a treaty with the Dominican Republic, and he wanted this treaty, and the Congress wouldn't sign off on it. So he just decided to call it not a treaty, but an executive agreement that he would just sign without the Senate's consent. And that set all kinds of terrible precedents. But his view was, we need somebody who's got robust energy. And if the legislature is going to be an obstacle to the exercise of the will of the people, then, out it goes. I mean, so that's not a good, I would say that's not a good example for people. I think Harry Truman's considered a near great these days. And okay. We'll leave out the nuclear, the atomic bombings, which I think is pretty terrible.
I know, horrendous.
But Harry Truman, I mean, all through his, I mean, he had, one of my favorite things is there was a shortage of meat after the war, because they still kept a lot of the wartime price controls going. So there's a shortage of meat. And instead of just getting rid of the price controls, he comes up with this plan that thankfully he didn't carry out. He was going to send the military out onto American farms to seize livestock. And that way he would deliver meat to the, I mean, just totally crazy. Or he attempted to seize the steel mills. Because they weren't doing what he wanted, and the Supreme Court had to intervene and say you cannot seize the steel mills. So again, this idea that I'm the president and doggone it, I'll do whatever I darn well please. But I mean, in terms of a president who's thought to be great and turned out to be crummy, I mean, I did talk about Lincoln because there he sets all kinds of precedents for suppressing free speech and suspending habeas corpus. And ignoring constitutional requirements and carving out the state of West Virginia unconstitutionally and all that. And and you could say, oh, but that was under pressure of war or whatever. Okay, but it was a war that was obviously an elective war. But secondly, the key thing here is he's the precedent now for, well, even Lincoln said that you could suppress free speech. And even Lincoln said that you can toss people in jail.
Caesar has become our god, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So those are my quick lightning round answers.
Okay, I feel like there's so many things I can ask you. This is a relatively short one, I think.
I'm down to 5% power on my computer. I should have brought my cord. So if I go away, that's why.
That's okay.
Okay. I'm interested in Thomas Jefferson because clearly he was like John Locke Mark II. He closed some libertarian gaps in John Locke's philosophy. But people say that as president, he wasn't libertarian or he broke some of his principles. Is that true? And what do you think are the things that he did that he shouldn't have done?
Okay, the main thing would be the embargo that he imposed as a way of trying to get the British and the French to change their behavior because they had been harassing American shipping. But he thought that the American economy was strong enough that the absence of trade with the U.S. would put enough economic pressure on those countries to get them to change their behavior. But it wasn't. And so all he did was harass Americans. And there were searches and seizures that did not reach, constitutional requirements, let's say. So that was definitely the big one. What usually people will point out is the Louisiana Purchase. And they'll say that the Constitution doesn't authorize that. But overwhelmingly, certainly his party did believe and had believed for a long time that you could enter into a treaty, and that a treaty that involved the transfer of territory was perfectly constitutionally legitimate. It was only Jefferson who had these qualms that maybe there was a constitutional obstacle. His allies were all saying, what are you talking about? There is no constitutional qualm here. So I think people are hitting him unjustly on that one, although it does involve the expenditure of tax money. So there is that. But the constitutional question, I don't think is as big of a deal. But the fact that he repealed all taxes except, basically a tariff, and then had, land sales were also a source of revenue for the government. But he let people out of prison who'd been jailed under the Alien and Sedition Acts for speaking out. And he refunded people who had been fined under that act and repaid them interest. And by and large, left people alone otherwise. I think his record, I think they've exaggerated the wickedness of his record. I think that's, we would kill for a president like that.
Sure. Yeah. What about him owning so many slaves?
Okay, but you asked specifically about as president. What
I
did
know,
you
I know, but I just
I know you're just giving me a hard time.
What's the answer to that?
Well, he's wrong about it, but his, okay. His views on slavery are a subject for another episode, because there is some interesting writing about how he wanted to try to deal with that in a way that would be best for everybody. And, you know, you could say he was too timid, but what was politically possible in Virginia at that time? And
I'll tell you somewhere where there's going to be no slavery. On the Contra Cruise.
Thank you so much, Tom. I feel like we could talk forever. I've enjoyed this so much. You have no idea. You're welcome back on the show anytime.
Well, thank you. Let me give a plug for tomsfreebooks.com. You can continue this in your own mind by going to Tom Woods, I beg your pardon, tomsfreebooks.com.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know Tom's podcast, Tom Woods Podcast, shame on you. Get over there right now to
Tom Woods. Exactly, the Tom Woods Show. Thank you, guys. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Thanks.
All right, folks, how's this for a neat website? whatsmadethere.com. Very interesting idea. It's aimed at the U.S. market, so if you're in Scotland, it won't be as interesting to you, but it features state-by-state maps listing common household products that are understood to have a significant part of their manufacturing and assembly process at the listed location. He's got about 400 map markers listed and counting, and the site is really just for people who are interested in where things are made, and let's say also people who might be interested in buying locally produced goods, things like that. You can find out all kinds of interesting things about a whole bunch of states and things that are produced there. What an interesting idea for a site. whatsmadethere.com is the site. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1228. And you can get your website mentioned if you get your hosting through me. You get a lot of other benefits too, including membership in my bloggers group. You're really going to like that. We got hundreds of people in there, and they're going to help you out. Other thing is, make sure and support my friends over at Free Talk Live. They've got an amazing libertarian call-in show. They are reaching people out there in the regular, normal world because they're all over the radio. You can also get them via podcast. Check them out at listen.freetalklive.com. All right, tomorrow we're talking about Thomas Jefferson. And in particular, we're going to talk about years of Jefferson's life that people know about less. And what emerges from this picture is really a more extraordinary historical figure than you may in fact have realized. So it's going to be a great conversation with our old friend Kevin Goodsman. Talk to you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.